Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The California State Assembly votes today on its version of a bill to cut prison spending by releasing thousands of inmates early over the next 2 years. By doing so, the state hopes to save $1.2 billion. But last week's gruesome abduction case could affect today's vote. Some lawmakers say the arrest of parolee Philip Garrido for the 1991 kidnapping of J.C. Lee Dugard might make some assembly members wary of passing any laws that would put convicts out on the streets. Joining us from Sacramento, California is Michael Rothfeld. He's covering the story for the LA Times. And Michael, prior to the J.C. Lee Dugard case and her being found in a tent compound in Philip Garrido's backyard last week, I understand that the Senate passed a much tougher version of the bill, and it called for releasing even more inmates. How would they do that?
Right. They were going to allow inmates to do home detention for the last year of their sentences, and also some sick and elderly inmates were going to be able to go on home detention. They were going to stop supervising some low-level offenders on parole, and they were going to reduce a number of other sentences for prisoners.
Mm-hmm. And because of the J.C. Dugard case, things have changed.
Well, this was happening even before that. There was a murder in Los Angeles that got a lot of attention. Over the years, prominent crimes tend to intimidate politicians from really making any changes on the prisons because they fear a backlash from the voters.
Mm-hmm. State Senator Tom Harmon is quoted as saying that the J.C. Dugard case demonstrates the problems that California is going to have if it does release prisoners. Does he have a point?
Well, Philip Garrido was on federal parole. This happened 18 years ago. So you really could take any crime and say, well, you can't do anything on the prisons if you look at that crime. But the fact is, I don't think this proposal really would have affected the J.C. Lee Dugard case one way or the other.
I think that some folks might be raising the question, though, of saying this is the case of a man who, for the past 9 months, his parole agent visited him a few times a month. He was basically under watch by the correction system, and still there was a woman being held there against her will for 18 years. Doesn't it raise questions about the parole system in general that could be applied to this legislation or no?
Well, I certainly think that you always want to have tighter parole supervision, and one of the problems in California is that the parole system is overworked. The corrections officials say this would actually tighten parole. This would reduce parole on low-level offenders, so according to the state, it would allow them to have more resources to focus on sex offenders like Mr. Garrido, and they'll have fewer numbers of people that they would have to supervise.
Mm-hmm. Could you give us a sense of the prison system in California? How overcrowded is it, and how much of a problem is this?
It's a huge problem, and they are under court order right now to come up with a plan to reduce by 40,000 inmates over 2 years. The prisons have about twice the capacity. There's 170,000 people in the system, and other ones are in private prisons and community programs and things like that. And over the years, they've just increased the number of people in there at an increasingly high cost to taxpayers.
Mm-hmm. Governor Schwarzenegger says the assembly, he's called the assembly gutless for the scaled-down version of this measure. How's that going over?
Not very well. They weren't too happy about that. The fact is that the assembly Democrats, who are the ones who are going to have to approve this, many of them are running for higher office. Three of the Democrats are running for attorney general. So they are in particular are pretty wary of voting for anything that could let them be portrayed as soft on crime. And so that's what the governor was referring to. When the Senate approved this, there was several hours of debate, and they only approved it by one vote. So in the assembly today, I expect particularly the Republicans to make a lot of hay over this. I believe the Democrats, too, will make a lot of speeches. I believe that so many provisions have been taken out of this. The home detention I mentioned is no longer in it. Some of the sentencing reductions have been taken out in response to law enforcement officials. So it's possible that so much has been taken out that law enforcement officials, local prosecutors and sheriffs and police have now given their permission, essentially, for the assembly members to sign off on it.
Well, if that much has been taken out, then how much would the prison population be reduced? And then, of course, how much would the state save in terms of prison spending?
Well, I believe they're estimating now somewhere around 15,000 would be taken out in the first year, as opposed to like 27,000 under the original proposal. So substantially fewer, and the plan now is about $200 million a year less, which would blow a $200 million hole in the state budget, which is certainly in crisis.
Michael Rothfeld covers California state politics for the LA Times. Michael, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Well, we turn now to the topic of modern-day slavery. It's commonly believed that slavery in the United States ended when it was abolished in 1865. But anti-slavery advocates say slavery is alive and well in this country, and they say a slave is trafficked into the U.S. every 36 minutes. The group Free the Slaves says the victims are everywhere, hidden in plain sight, washing dishes in neighborhood restaurants or sweeping the floors of department stores. And the group cites State Department estimates suggesting that some 17,000 people are trafficked into the U.S. each year. Some skeptics question those numbers. They say since 2000, the U.S. has identified only 1,300 victims of human trafficking here. We're going to hear from a former modern-day slave in just a moment, but first we're joined by Dr. Kevin Bales. He's president and co-founder of the group Free the Slaves. He's also author of the new book, The Slave Next Door, and he joins us from the studios of the BBC in Manchester, England. Welcome, Kevin.
Great to be here.
First of all, give us the big picture on slavery. You write that for most of us in the U.S., slavery probably creeps into our lives several times in a day. Is it more of a problem in other parts of the world? And how does it affect so many people?
Well, in terms of people who are enslaved, the greatest majority of those are in South Asia, Southeast Asia, North and West Africa. That's where the big numbers are, probably 20 to 25 million people in slavery. And the way that it touches Americans several times a day is actually more likely to be in the products that we use, because all over the developing world, people are enslaved and doing mineral extraction or basic agricultural commodities and that sort of thing. And those things flow into a global market and then flow into our homes. And it can be cotton, steel, cocoa, chocolate. It can be the coltan mineral that's in our cell phones and like that, sugar, tea, coffee. The list is very long. So while there are not a very large number of slaves in the United States, we're touched by it through the things that we buy.
I'm wondering, in your book, when you write about some of the personal stories of slaves and folks who own slaves, you have one story about a woman. Her name is Sandra Bearden, and she's from Texas. And she actually had a young woman come and live with her as domestic help, and then that turned into a case of slavery. Can you explain briefly that particular case, and is that something that's typical? What does it say about this issue?
Certainly a lot about that case. It's typical. Someone wanting help in their home, reaching out across the border into Mexico, finding a 14-year-old in this case, making a lot of promises, a chance for school and a lot of other things, good pay, bringing them into their home to use as a domestic worker. But the part that's, I have to say, even for me, is very puzzling and very mysterious is the way then a middle-class housewife descends into a spiral of violence, brutality, and torture. The absolute power over another individual will often absolutely corrupt their notions of propriety or how they might treat another person.
There are also the issue of sex slaves. Those particular cases tend to get a lot of attention, especially from the U.S. government. Would you say that in the U.S. most slaves are sex slaves, or are they more, you know, like someone in the case of Sandra Bearden, are we talking about domestic slaves where things sort of get out of hand?
The research tends to suggest that just under half of all the people enslaved in the United States are enslaved into prostitution or sexual exploitation, and that the next highest category, which would be about 15 to 20% of the people enslaved in the U.S., are in those situations of domestic slavery. After that is agricultural workers, and after that are workers in restaurants, sweatshops, that kind of thing. And then after that, there's a huge kind of potpourri category of people who are in all kinds of jobs that you could never even dream of, where there might be slavery, like the cannoli factory that I saw in Long Island.
Well, Kevin, one of the slaves you write about has an unusual slave story, typically not someone you would think of as a slave, and he is on the line with us right now. 22-year-old Given Cachepa is in Colleyville, Texas. Given, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Your story is complicated, but if we summarize it, basically you were in Zambia, you're an orphan, and an American missionary chose you to sing in a choir group to tour in the United States. The missionary was Keith Grimes, and his group is TTT Partners in Education. And you and other boys in Zambia were brought to the United States to sing. How old were you? And tell us, what was it like when you got to this country?
I was 11 years of age. And when I came to the United States, I was excited to be here because we were supposed to be raising funds for schools for our community back home in Zambia. And then we were supposed to be getting an American education as well. But unfortunately, none of those things took place. We were singing in churches, singing in colleges, and so we pretty much became what you would call a modern-day slave, in that we didn't have our freedom to tell anybody about our situation, because if we did, we were threatened with deportation.
How often would they make you sing, and what were the conditions like where you were, and did you ever get the U.S. education that they told you they were going to give you?
We used to sing 4 to 7 concerts a day. It looked like they were paying us, but really we had to pay back so much that at the end of the month you ended up only with about $45 per month. And so we were trapped for 2 years, and then thankfully in the year 2000 the American government became involved and we were rescued, and we found places to go in the United States, and things turned out to be better for us.
Mm. Now, many folks listening to this might say, choir slavery? Is that really slavery?
Well, you know, that's actually, you know, the deceiving thing, in that when you hear of trafficking, you don't tend to think of it in terms of, you know, a choir. But, you know, trafficking is so deceiving, you know, you don't really know where it's happening. And until you really get to know a situation and really find out what's taking place, then you can't really know.
There was an investigation of the choir, and the officials said, well, the boys aren't shackled, and you didn't appear to be slaves, so it must have been difficult to know that the folks in charge of investigating your situation really didn't think it was all that bad at first.
Right. That's probably the most deceiving thing about trafficking, in that, you know, you can go to a supermarket and run into anybody, and they could be a trafficking victim, but you just don't know it because, you know, they're not going to tell you everything that they're going through, but underneath, they really are a slave.
Given you were eventually adopted by a woman in Texas,
right,
and you were able to continue your education, tell us, what are you doing now?
Well, I just graduated from college, and I'll be going back for a post-baccalaureate. I'm trying to get into dental school. I'm studying for the dental admission exam right now, and I hope to work hard and achieve my goal.
Well, Given, good luck to you.
Thank you.
That's Given Kachepa, who says that as a young orphan from Zambia, he became a slave in a missionary choir that toured Texas during the late 1990s. We're also speaking with Kevin Bales. He's president and co-founder of the group Free the Slaves. He'll be back with us after a break. And later in the show, the children of rape during the Rwandan genocide. It's Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Kevin Bales, president and co-founder of the advocacy group Free the Slaves. His new book is The Slave Next Door. And Kevin, what about the numbers of slaves estimated to be in this country? These estimates have fluctuated wildly over the past 10 years. At first, we heard numbers that 50,000 people were trafficked into the U.S. every year, and now that's been downgraded to somewhere between 14 and 17,500 people. And some say that even those numbers are exaggerated. Not to minimize this, but how is it possible to get a good idea of how widespread this problem might be?
It's very difficult. It's a hidden crime. It's one of the greatest methodological challenges I've ever faced as a social scientist. There was a dramatic drop after 9/11 because so much of our law enforcement capacity was redirected to border control. And we think that's in part some of the reason for the drop from 50,000 to 14.5 to 17,500. This is a crime unlike almost any other except possibly kidnapping in terms of trying to measure it. With almost every crime, you have a victim and you have an event, which is the crime itself. So if I get mugged, 5 minutes later, I'm a victim of mugging, but the mugging doesn't continue for the rest of my life. When you enslave someone, they actually disappear, as it were, from the social reality, and the crime itself continues until either they die or they're set free or they escape or something like that. And the difficulty is that you can't find victims who are hidden during the process of their victimization. Mm-hmm. It's a funny one, but it means that it's tough to count. My best guess, and this is based on a triangulated piece of research that I did for the United Nations a few years ago, is that very conservatively we have 40 to 50,000 people in slavery in the United States.
And then at the end of 2007, the numbers indicate that there were only about 1,300 victims of human trafficking that had been brought into the United States confirmed. That's obviously a very different number, very small.
Well, that's the number confirmed by federal government. But in fact, if you go out and speak to the service providers, the people who work with victims of trafficking but who are not linked to the government, you'll find you add several thousand more people. And if you speak to ethnic support groups for Chinese, Mexicans, Salvadorians, and so forth, you'll turn up another 2,000 or 3,000.
What can people do about this? First of all, to recognize that it might be a problem. When you mentioned the case, of Given Kachepa in the choir in Texas, brought here from Zambia, how would someone know that we were talking about slavery in that case? Or how would they take action to let corporations know that they're not going to support products that may have come about because of slavery?
Well, first, in terms of identifying someone in slavery, and I appreciate that, you know, these boys, like Given Kachepa, were singing in front of thousands of people a week. A handful of them said, something's not right here. But they never said to themselves, gosh, these kids look like they might be enslaved. But what you're looking for are people who seem beaten down, seem cowed, seem disoriented, don't know necessarily where they are. In terms of what we do about companies and the products that we use, the best model is probably that of the chocolate companies, because the chocolate companies are confronting the fact that they've got slavery in cocoa in West Africa, and they have been working with consumers and with the governments of West Africa to intervene and take that slavery out of that commodity. Now, that's actually much more effective than trying to talk about boycotts, because the amount of slavery in any commodity in the world is usually rarely more than 4 or 5%. And that means that every time you make a boycott, you harm the farmers or the producers that are actually honest and have families to support in order to get at the 2 or 3 farmers out of 100 that actually might be using slave labor.
What do you think slavery costs us in this country, the United States, as an economy and then as a country?
It costs us too little at the moment in terms of enforcement, because the $100 to $200 million a year that we spend isn't enough to get the job done by a long shot. And we're just barely keeping track of it.
Aren't our agricultural products, though, aren't they less expensive because of the labor issue and what's used in many of the major farms in this country?
If they are cheaper, the agricultural products, they're cheaper by so little that it gets lost in the transport cost and the retail cost. But in terms of what it costs us morally as a country, well, that's the big question. Because this is a country that was founded on the idea that there would be freedom for every person within our borders. And then we fought a war over this question and brought it into our Constitution that we would live in the land of the free. But there's never been a moment in the history of the United States that has been free, not from the very first settler right up to today. There's never been a day without slavery in America, and I think that is an enormous moral burden for us.
Kevin, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks.
Kevin Bales is with the group Free the Slaves and author of the book The Slave Next Door. Well, a remarkable survival story is being told today by three fishermen from Texas who spent 8 days stranded on the hull of their capsized boat in the Gulf of Mexico. The trio endured the blistering sun, hallucinations, and shark scares, and the Coast Guard even gave up searching for them. But crew member Trussell Hawkins told NBC's Today Show how they managed to survive after their boat flipped over.
We managed to salvage 2 bags of chips, 6-pack of crackers, and 3 gallons of water, and that's what we lived on for the 8 days.
The men also rationed chewing gum they salvaged and used a hose to drink water out of a washed-down tank that was inside the capsized boat. The crew of a passing sport fishing boat spotted the missing men and rescued them Saturday. They were reunited with their families early yesterday. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the debate over sending women into combat. Some say they're already there because of the way wars have changed. Also, what happens when you combine a multiple Grammy-winning banjo star, a MacArthur Genius double bass player, and an Indian tabla master? Well, if it's Bela Fleck, Edgar Meyer, and Zakir Hussain, they make beautiful music together. That's coming up tomorrow. Still ahead today, the Pentagon cancels a controversial contract with a PR firm that profiles reporters who asked for permission to embed with U.S. troops in Afghanistan. We'll be back after the news. It's Here and Now. The fallout continues over Scotland's decision to release the only man convicted in the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie. Yesterday, more than 200 people gathered in Inglewood, New Jersey, to tell Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi that he is not welcome there. The protesters included several people whose loved ones were among the 270 killed in the bombing. The protest started because Gaddafi planned to pitch a ceremonial-style Bedouin tent on the grounds of a Libyan-owned estate in Inglewood. Late last week, Gaddafi's representative said he would stay in Manhattan, but that did not stop yesterday's protest. The BBC's Matthew Wells reports.
Well, I'm next to an angry crowd in the middle of a plush New Jersey suburb, gathered right against the fence of a large property owned by the Libyan government. We're all standing in the home of America's best-known TV rabbi. There's a large Jewish community here in Englewood, and Colonel Gaddafi's been viewed as one of their most implacable international enemies for a long time now.
And if one of my children hits a baseball over that fence that they just erected after ripping mine down, it goes into Libya. I don't want the terror-financing government to be in so close proximity to my children.
Rabbi Shmuley Butak has watched workers preparing for the Libyan leader's visit just a few metres away. Diplomats say he'll now be staying put in nearby Manhattan, but the rabbi believes the tent protest is a turning point.
Some say he's done penitence, but we know after watching him embrace al-Megrahi 2 weeks ago in Tripoli that he is a pious fraud, a religious charlatan. We will defeat you, we will keep you out of our neighbourhood, and we will keep you out of our country. And I believe that from Englewood, your decline will begin.
It is truly an honor for me to introduce John and Kathleen Flynn.
Local family members of some who were killed in the Lockerbie bombing condemned the Gaddafi visit. But the most impassioned speech came from Libyan Mohammed al-Jami, whose dissident brother died recently after a lengthy prison spell in Tripoli.
For the memory of every victim of Mr. Gaddafi, please restrict the despot's visa to the island of Manhattan. The U.S. has done it before and surely can do it again. Thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you for having me here.
Pipers from the local police joined demonstrators in a gesture of solidarity, but continuing anger against the Scottish and British justice ministries over the Lockerbie bombers' release repeatedly rose to the surface. Here's veteran New Jersey Senator Frank Lautenberg.
When I heard what the Minister of Justice, McCaskill, said when he delivered his message about the return of Megrahi, I said one thing. It's a common British term. Rubbish! That's what it was. Rubbish!
For the ramparts we were.
As the crowd grimly celebrated their local victory, there was exasperation at Libya's continuing rehabilitation on the international stage. Englewood's mayor, Michael Wilds, believes the world's gone soft on Gaddafi.
Are we taking an intermission on the war on terrorism at this point? This is laughable that he would even think to have the audacity to ask for a red carpet in a white tent. He should be locked up in jail as an accomplice to murder.
So how are you going to remove this property here and take the Libyans out of the city?
The old-fashioned American gumption. I got elected with 14 pair of Florsheim shoes, and I'll do whatever I have to do to see him off U.S. soil.
For the Israel-supporting suburban heartland of New Jersey, Colonel Gaddafi is beyond the pale and beyond reform. It's clear that the clamour of protest will continue wherever his entourage sets foot on American soil.
That report from the BBC's Matthew Wells in Englewood, New Jersey. Just a reminder, you can listen to our show stream live on our website, hereandnow.org, or you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's hereandnow.org. Coming up after a quick break, the controversy over the military's use of a PR firm to rate the coverage of embedded reporters. It's Here and Now. The Pentagon is canceling a controversial $1.5 million contract with a public relations firm that profiles reporters who want to embed with U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Stars and Stripes newspaper first reported last week that the firm, the Rendon Group, rated reporters' war coverage as either negative, positive, or neutral, and in some cases suggested ways to manipulate news stories. The Pentagon denies that any reporters' rating system exists. Officials there say that these screenings give them an idea of a reporter's work. Kevin Barron covers the Pentagon for Stars and Stripes, and he helped break this story. And Kevin, why is the Pentagon now saying it's canceling the contract with the Rendon Group?
The admiral, who is the head of communications down in Afghanistan, just said it's become a big distraction for them. And they said all along that since this latest command has taken control of the operations there and of this contract in June, that they really haven't used these reports, they haven't looked at them as much, and they just thought, this has become a distraction that's not worth the effort.
And became a distraction because of the stories that your newspaper wrote about what these profiles involve.
Well, I like to think so, yeah.
Can you explain exactly what these profiles were?
Sure. It was kind of a background summary of any reporter who applies to be embedded with the troops in Afghanistan. And anybody who wants to cover the war has to go through this process. If the press officer in Afghanistan wanted to know more about you, they'd call up the Rendon Group, this private PR firm, and they would give a couple-page summary, maybe some charts and graphs also, that would look at your background, your bio, and then also take a whole bunch of your previous works and would grade them or characterize them as positive, negative, or neutral. And then on the bottom of some of these would have some clear direction of whether or not they thought, based on your work, that the reporter could be steered in a way that would result in more positive coverage for the military.
Steered in a way, meaning specific, explicit suggestions about how to manipulate news coverage.
Well, yeah, and they would say, given this past work, if given the right opportunities, we think that we could get some positive coverage from this reporter. That's what the profiles say. You know, we spoke to an actual spokesman of the 101st Airborne Division who left Afghanistan in May, who said, last year they were using these reports exactly the way that we had assumed, that they were looking at them and deciding, based on the work of the reporter, whether or not they wanted to give the embed at all or whether or not to, give the specific requested, topics or areas that the embedded journalist wanted to report about.
The Pentagon says that it did not deny access or deny permission to embed based on these profiles.
The Pentagon said that since June, since this new command, they were very specific about this, that since June that they had not been using these profiles to make that sort of a decision. Again, the admiral is in charge now, and his statement to us yesterday made the same assertion, saying, since I've been here, we've not done this thing. I can't speak for the past, but they don't think that it's something systemic. But it didn't take us long, to find a spokesman for the 101st who said, no, that's exactly how we use these reports. That's how we were told. They came in packets from our superiors, especially for reporters who we weren't familiar with, for newer reporters or from smaller outlets or bloggers. When we needed to know more about their background, we'd get this background information.
And did you find any case where it may have been used in a different way than what has been suggested since June?
Since June, no. You know, the spokesman down there, Colonel Shanks, has said these things are just total benign background for us. We've barely looked at them. I've barely requested them. This really is something that, you know, was handed to us from the previous group. They've really tried to play it down. What we have found, though, there was a reporter at the Pentagon who requested to see her profile, and it took the press officer in Afghanistan all of, 30 seconds to call up the PR firm, get it, and send it to the reporter. Since then, however, lots of reporters wanted to see them, and suddenly they weren't offering them. They weren't letting reporters see their profiles.
Now, it would seem that there would have to be some sort of information gathered on journalists when they're trying to get into Afghanistan because of what's happening over there. So what's wrong with the practice of trying to figure out exactly who a reporter is and what a journalist writes about before they're allowed to embed with U.S. troops?
Well, you're exactly right. You know, there's nothing wrong with doing your homework. What the problem here, we thought, was for two things. Number one, why was an outside firm being paid $1.5 million to do what seemed to be a little bit more than Googling, just looking up previous work? And secondly, this idea of rating a reporter's work positive, negative, neutral. Now, the Pentagon spokesman here said, look, we don't do that kind of thing here. I've had contractors come to me and offer this service. We don't think there's any value in it. All we care about is accuracy. And also, the rules of this embed system that goes back to the previous administration, to the beginning of the wars, the rules are explicit to say that this is not designed to prevent embarrassing news coming out from the military and from the reporting. This is supposed to be our way of safely and efficiently facilitating journalists to cover this war, to do it in a way that's, protects them and protects us. And it's the system that we still have right now.
These background profiles that the Rendon Group did for the military are just one part of that $1.5 million contract. What exactly is it supposed to do?
Well, nobody knows. We've seen the contract statements, and if you know anything about federal contracting, when you look at some contracts, it can be very vague, the scope of work. We're trying to find out more about that. We've demanded to see not only this contract, but some previous work as well. But the way it's been told to us by the Rendon Group itself, by the spokesman in Afghanistan and here at the Pentagon, is that they do general media analysis, which can range from anything to these content analysis reports, which is what you call these profiles. They look at your past work. But the Rendon Group itself has got a controversial history, we'll say. They have a history with the CIA, a history with the Iraqi National Congress, with planting articles written by the military into local Iraqi papers as if they were written by journalists without, sourcing them to the military.
Well, let's explain that a little bit. I mean, the Rendon Group, really one of the major controversies involving the Rendon Group was over its role in helping the Bush administration make the case to invade Iraq. Can you tell us about that?
The Rendon Group, they were part of setting up this Iraqi National Congress, which was the group of exiled Iraqis led by Chalabi, who was supposed to come back and be the new democratic free government that was going to save the day after Saddam Hussein was removed.
And the group that supplied a bunch of the information about the weapons of mass destruction.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So overall, do you think that this raises serious questions, really, about the control of information on the part of the Pentagon?
Well, it does. These Rendon profiles, as it was told to us by this previous press officer, are just one way that the press officers would look at your past work and look at whether or not it was good or bad, positive or negative, before they made their judgment whether or not to grant your embed request. And that's just not what the rules say you're supposed to do. But it's a new White House, and we'll see. We'll see if anything more changes beyond just canceling this contract, if leadership will send the word out that, let's get back to the original point of this embed system, which was facilitating journalists where they need to go.
Kevin Barron covers the Pentagon for Stars and Stripes newspaper. Kevin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email or call 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And before we go today, the stories of rape victims of the Rwandan genocide and their children born from violence. It's Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life, Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. We have a warning for this next conversation. It may not be appropriate for young ears. It's about some of the still lingering consequences of the Rwandan genocide.
It was on that fateful day on the 9th when it all started. I remember I was in my home with my husband. We had just ended our honeymoon when they attacked our village.
From April to June of 1994, more than 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed in Rwanda, among them the husband of a woman named Valentine.
I saw my husband, and I realized he had died. They had come to kill.
The genocide was carried out by radical Hutus and followed long-standing conflicts between Hutus and Tutsis. After Valentine's husband was murdered, she and hundreds of thousands of other women were raped and tortured. And now the children of those rapes are teenagers. The estimates of how many of these children are living in Rwanda range from 2 to 25,000. Jonathan Targovnik has put together some of the stories of these children and their mothers in the new book, Intended Consequences, Rwandan Children Born of Rape. There's also an accompanying CD where translators read stories like Valentine's, and you can see some of the photos of the women and children in Jonathan's book at our website, hereandnow.org. And Jonathan joins us from NPR studios in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's my understanding you first traveled to Rwanda in 2006 when you were doing an assignment for Newsweek magazine, a story on AIDS at the time. And can you tell us how that led you to this topic?
Yeah, sure. I met this woman named Margaret that was brutally raped during the genocide. And she told us, of course, that as a consequence of those rapes, she contracted HIV/AIDS. But also in passing, she mentioned that she became pregnant and had a baby boy. And at that point, I just thought to myself, how many children like this are in Rwanda? You know, I just decided to go back to Rwanda on my own accord to start documenting the stories, interviewing these women, to really look at the consequences of sexual violence, consequences of genocide.
In the book, you have a story of the woman named Philomena, and her daughter is Juliet. And she talks a little bit about not being able to have any maternal feelings, really, for the child who is the result of a rape during the genocide. Let's listen to a clip of that.
Whenever I look at this child, I trigger back to the memories of rape. Whenever I look at her, I imagine those men holding my legs. Maybe with time, I will love this daughter of mine. Maybe. But for now, no.
When she said that, I actually kind of challenged her and I said, you know, look, you know, I look at your daughter. She's beautiful. She's going to school right now. I mean, how can you tell me you don't love her? She put her hand on me and she said, I know this is terrible saying this as a mother, but this is what I feel. You know, the interesting thing is I just came back from Rwanda a few weeks ago. And she also, in addition to saying that she does not love her daughter, she went through really a horrific, horrific experience during the genocide. She was forced to watch her mother being raped when she was only 14 or 15. And then raped next to her mother, and her sister was raped next to her as well. And she told us during the interview that she could never think of being with a man again. And in this just recent trip, this is 3 years after my original interview with her, she got married. In fact, she got married while I was there. So I attended her wedding. I took pictures of her wedding. And it was such a happy, joyful moment. A little sad note on that wedding, though, was that the daughter was very on the sidelines. She was present at the wedding. She was not dressed very well like everybody else. She was not, and when they were taking kind of family pictures, she was not part of that group. And that was very sad to see. So probably she still feels those very divided feelings towards her daughter.
It raises so many questions. Do you think that, first of all, is this something that typically they hadn't spoken with their families about and maybe not with the children involved either?
First of all of the women except one that I interviewed did not tell their children yet the circumstances of how they were born. Although most of them said that they think the children know. Both the children and the mothers are very stigmatized by their surrounding communities. If you're a single mother, not living in your original village where you were born, with a 15-year-old child today, and in the physical features of the child, you could see that they're a mix of a Hutu and Tutsi, it's very easy to conclude what happened here. So the kids, you know, people in school say things to them, or on the street, they say things to them, and they come back home, and ask the mother, you know, why are they saying these things? And the mother are denying it right now. They're not ready to tell their children.
You mentioned that a lot of the families did not accept these children of Hutu militiamen. And there is a story in your book of Esperance. And she tells of going to see her family after she considered committing suicide. And her mother asks her, why did you have to bring this militiaman here? Let's listen.
No one wants him. No one. When he plays, they say he wants to kill. When he throws a stone, they say he has the behavior of a militia. Whenever they look at him, they say his people killed my family.
Jonathan, do you think that most of the families feel that way? And how can the children not feel that too?
Unfortunately, the answer is yes. Most of them are this way. I noticed myself in some cases, you know, these kids, they're coming of age, they're becoming teenagers, and you know, every teenager does naughty things, but immediately for these mothers, in many cases, whenever they do something naughty, immediately they associate that with the father. And you know, it's that blood in him, like they say. But not all the women feel this way. Some of the women were very, very loving of their children. In one case, one of the women said, when I asked her, do you love your child? She said, try to say something bad about my son. Let's see you. I dare you. Mm. You know, with sense of humor. And I really feel, from being with these women, that they really do love their children, even the ones that say they don't, because they are taking care of them, and they have, I could see the connection they have, but for many it's very, very difficult to just say it publicly.
But do you think that they confided in their families at all, or friends?
The families, in most cases, unfortunately, are not a safety net like we would expect them to be. Rather, they're stigmatized against. My personal consequences of this project was coming back after several years of working on this and seeing how they're suffering, how they don't have any support system and a safety net, was to start a foundation that will support these mothers and these children. It's called Foundation Rwanda, and supports the secondary school education of these children, and also gives holistic support to the women and links them to medical and psychological help when it's available.
Why wouldn't these children and these women be taken care of by the government of Rwanda or the agencies that help genocide survivors? Aren't they considered genocide survivors?
No. You're considered a survivor if you were born before the genocide.
The women are considered survivors, though.
The women are, but again, the children are not. And you know, one of the last things I always ask them is, what are your hopes for the future? They look at me and say, you know, the word future for us is an abstract. We live day to day because in addition to all the traumas they live with, they're extremely poor. When I ask them, okay, if you would have means, what would be your dream and hopes for your children? And they all said education. It was amazing. They really understand in their simple life the value of education for their children. And they know that if their kids will be able to stay in the school system, they'll be able to develop the skills to provide for themselves. And this is why when I came back, I really thought that's the thing we should try to help them with.
Jonathan Trigovnik is author of Intended Consequences, Rwandan Children Born of Rape. Jonathan, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.